So for today's talk, as I was meditating, before I got really peaceful, I remembered I'd just come back from Indonesia on Tuesday, giving some talks and teaching meditation over there. Had a wonderful time, really working hard, because the books which I've written over there are really, really, really popular. So popular that it's even in the main bookshop chain. It's called Gramedia. It was told that my books, the Opening the Door of Your Heart, which was translated into Indonesia, is the all-time number three bestseller in that bookshop chain throughout Indonesia. And the manager of the bookshop said, please, 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 don't try to improve to get to number two or number one. Because number two is the Bible and number one is the Quran. I would get into big trouble if I tried to do any further. But anyway, it means that all these people have come to my talks. It's usually a couple of thousand on average. And lots of people are learning meditation. But thinking of what can I put my talk around today, the title of the whole tour in Indonesia was called Zero Ego. No self, no ego. So wow, what a wonderful title for this evening's talk. Because sometimes you think, how can, when you sort of get so well known, can you learn how to disappear as well? Have no ego. This is important to be able to do this. So I have great fun being a monk and learning how just to sometimes disappear. I don't mean just in meditation. That's quite an easy thing to do. But sometimes when I just travel around the world or even in Bodhidharma Monastery, sometimes you can sort of vanish and people don't know who you are. Like that time some years ago when I was building. You see Bodhidharma Monastery, you see the Nuns Monastery, Jhana Grove. You'll often see many of the monks out there with the shovels, with the chainsaws, with the wheelbarrows, and of course with me with the trowel laying bricks and building stuff. And one of my favorite occupations, which people don't let me do, actually perhaps I should do more of it when people aren't watching, is mixing concrete. I don't know why, but when I see a concrete truck, I think, wow, what a wonderful machine that is. Because I've mixed so much concrete in my life building Bodhidharma Monastery. And there was this one occasion I was there with the other monks, shoveling in the sand, shoveling in the cement, shoveling in the blue metal. And people say, oh, don't do that, Ajahn Brahm. We can get a truck for you and get some workers, some professors. I said, no, I love this stuff. It's, you know, almost like a hobby, like you enjoy it. And afterwards, you know, you can actually see what you've done. You get so much fulfillment. They have like a house or a kuti or a place where, you know, you can come and stay, like the patio over in Bodhidharma Monastery, which I built years ago, so you can actually have your lunches there. And so all this is my giving, and I love that sort of stuff. But the problem is, when people see me, they keep saying, Ajahn Brahm, you're too old to mix concrete. But then, no. The last time I really did any serious work was when in the Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. I was on top of the roof fixing some plumbing. I was quite okay until somebody took a photograph of me and they put it on the internet. They shouldn't have done that. Because I got all of these comments from people. Ajahn Brahm, you're too valuable to put on top of a roof. So no, I won't fall off. You're always not thinking of falling off, you're just wondering if the rafters can withstand your weight. But anyway, when I was, please excuse this story, but I can't resist telling it. When I was busy sort of mixing concrete one day, and of course you get very dirty. You know, just get cement all over. You've got your work clothes on. And sometimes you see some of our monks down in Bodhidharma Monastery, you've got a bit of paint on here, a bit of dirt on there, because, you know, we work. And so I was coming back from the work site, and this very refined Sri Lankan Buddhist came to see me. She was coming, and I was passing on the path. And so she took one look at me, and she said, do you know where I can find Ajahn Brahm? I never let on I was Ajahn Brahm, because I didn't look like Ajahn Brahm. I looked some dirty, rough old monk. So thinking quickly, I still got a good brain. I said, if you go down to the hall over there, he'd probably be there in 15 minutes. And it worked perfectly. 15 minutes was enough for me to take a shower and put on a clean robe and go and speak to this lady. And she was asking all questions about Buddhism and meditation and the monastery. She was really impressed. And afterwards, she said, that's a wonderful, you know, I'm really glad to meet you, Ajahn Brahm. You've got a beautiful monastery, except for one thing. I said, what is it? And she said, on my way here, I met one of your monks, and he was very dirty and badly dressed. That should not happen in your monastery. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, ma'am. I'll talk to that monk later. She never realized it was me. So that's a wonderful way. If ever I want to go incognito and disappear and vanish and have zero ego, and it's not recognizable ego, it's great to work. Because when you work, sometimes people don't think that's what a senior monk is supposed to do. Or other stuff. Other stuff. I'd love to go on public transport. Not just going in a car from place to place. And when I go on public transport, wherever I can, my next trip is over to Sydney on Monday, and I made sure, at least I'm trying, please don't mess up my plans, I've got my Opal card. You know what an Opal card is? It's this little card you can go travel on the buses and trains in Sydney. Great fun. And see if anyone recognizes me. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but it's great when they don't. Like when I was on the underground trains in London. On the underground trains, I was sitting, you know, calmly just minding my own business, and a woman came sat right next to me, and she said to me, are you a Buddhist monk? I said, yes. I said, a real one? I remember when she said that, I don't know what a fake one is. I said, yeah, I'm a real Buddhist monk. I said, oh, great, wonderful. Just, can I ask some questions about Buddhism? And she was really interested. And because you were a monk in a public space, then people could come and actually ask you questions. Even here, I try to be as open and as available as possible, but how many of you are here, how many are there of me? It's impossible to give you all that time. But on a train, you know, going through the tunnels of London, then it's easy. You know, you can spend quite a 25 minutes talking. And it's not just me talking. I know this, I used to live in London. All the other passengers on the train also listen without admitting it. They've got their heads down here, but their ears are open. If there were kangaroos, because kangaroos, you can know who they're listening to because their ears actually move. And you can actually see they've noticed you because their ears are moving this way and that way. Kangaroos are really good. But anyway, I was giving some answers to her questions. And of course, then we came up to the question about reincarnation, because that's part of Buddhism, rebirth. So what about that? And I said, oh yeah, that's interesting you asked me that question, because about a month earlier, or 2 months earlier, I was teaching a retreat here in Perth, And this Italian meditator, he came and told me this really weird experiences he had in meditation. He's Italian, okay. So in his meditation, he had this feeling, almost like, you know, weird experience, that he was a piece of spaghetti. Now, you do have some very strange experiences in meditation. That's way up there. It was among the most experiences. But he's also said, this is not the first time. He said another day, at my retreat, that he felt that he was a piece of ravioli. And I had to sort of open my mind and think and make my mind peaceful to get some insight. What's going on? Thinking you're a piece of ravioli and then you're a piece of spaghetti. And of course, when you have enough experience of meditation, the answer just comes up. And it was obvious. I should have got it straight away. And I said, sir, you are recollecting your past lives. Hey, I got a good response there. But that was actually true. I told that story on the underground in London. And it was a magic moment. I wish somebody had videoed it, because maybe about 40 or 50 people in the carriage at the time, and they all stopped reading their newspapers, or actually, texting, and they all looked up at me. Half of them laughed, the other half groaned, but I don't mind. And at least they were listening all the time. And this is what can happen when you just zero ego and you don't intend to be a big mug or a small mug. You're just a mug and have a wonderful time with people. Because sometimes if you do become a celebrity, oh, it's just such a pain in the butt. You can't say anything because people always listen to you expecting something wise. And sometimes I say something stupid. And they say, oh, I don't understand that, but it must be profound. What's going on? Thinking you're a piece of ravioli.
So sometimes I like it when I can disappear. What was that other time I disappeared?
When you have enough experience of meditation.
Because I also love going to conferences. I love conferences, because at conferences you can actually sit in the back and vanish, or you can present and all sorts of different things. In conferences, because you practice zero ego, you can just give a talk about anything. Even here, what was it over in the 6PR?
In London.
Is it still going, 6PR?
And it was a
radio
moment. I wish
one of the friends, I don't know where he's gone these days, probably got in the sack, I don't know. But anyway, he invited me to his program, 6PR. He said, you've got all these people and they do talkback radio. And he said, you'll be great at this. Let's get you on board. So I said, it's a very busy life. I've got so many other things to do. He said, I'll come just once. I said, okay, I'll come after the Friday night talk at Nolomara, because that's the time I'm in town. Other times I'm in Serpentine or overseas or somewhere. So he said, yeah, okay, after the Friday night talk, come to the studio, we'll put you inside the thing where they give the talks, the talk back, and we'll just get you on the show. So you know what it's like here for me? After the talk, I ask, are there any questions? And everyone is quiet, so we finish off, and then there's all these questions. Every week that happens. It's so hard to get out there. So eventually I managed to rush out and get into a car and go into East Perth and get into the studios. And I was like, I only made it. I had to rush right through and get in the studio. And as soon as I sat down in the studio, the red lights came on and the microphone was right in front of me, headphones on, ready to actually perform. 10 o'clock. It was a 10 o'clock to midnight show. Now, I don't listen to the radio, so I don't know what type of show goes on between 10 p.m. and 9 and midnight, but apparently it was one of those shows on adult themes. I should have done some research, or you guys should have helped me out and warned me. So there I was for 2 hours, just taking calls from the general public on the most intimate matters of their life as a Buddhist monk. Now, first of all, I still remember this. The interviewer, it was too hard to pronounce my name, Ajahn Brahm. So, in the end, he just had to agree really quickly, call me Mr. Monk. I don't mind, and see what ego, call me Mr. Monk. He wasn't doing that out of disrespect, it was just, you know, just something the interviewer could say, Mr. Monk. And he said, I'd like to introduce Mr. Monk, you know, Buddhist monk, very senior, got a big following, lots of books written, to answer your questions this evening. And also, we've got this, I think I remember her name, Dr. Morrissey, who is the author of many well-known books in Australia on sexual things. And that's when I thought, uh-oh, what have I got myself into now? But there's one thing about which I've already noticed in myself, just listen to the questions and give the answers as it comes out from you. And they're usually pretty good answers. And they were, to the point that through that whole 2 hours, about 90% of the questions, honestly, were coming to me. Because people said, this question is for Mr. Mark, this question is for Mr. Mark. All the time. And there's something about that which was, you know, not sort of just winding me up. It was just interesting getting some information from the general public and giving answers. And mostly just being kind.
It was too hard to
not being sort of superior because I'm a monk. That's not zero ego at all. That's having big ego, listening and respecting one another. And that's only something you can do when you do have get to zero ego, being able to respect other people. And that was something which, again, I learned. I learned that, especially going to places like prisons.
To answer your question,
because I didn't know what to do when I first went into prison to teach meditation or just to talk to the prisoners. It was something which very few people wanted to do. There were dangerous places in those days. But, you know, you went in there. And one of the things which I always remember to do, that the people I met inside the jails of Western Australia, and also gone to other jails as well in our world, the people you see there, they're people first. They're human beings. Yeah, they've done some very bad things, but there's more to them than the bad things. So one thing I always remember to do is to respect them. It's just part of my training, part of loving kindness. We always say, may all beings be happy and well. May be free from pain and suffering. May all beings receive forgiveness. I mentioned this even today to somebody. They said it was a strange statement, but you can understand it. They say, when I'm angry and cruel, I feel like powerful. You can understand that. You know, you're actually doing something. You matter.
They
said, yes, and I'll be, you feel more powerful when you forgive. Especially you forgive something which is, you know, people find so difficult to forgive. There's incredible power there. Now, being cruel is easy. Forgiving is really difficult. And if you can actually get that energy up, and that, a lot of time it's courage, not so much energy, that sense of, why not? Then actually you become an incredibly powerful person. And it's a powerful event to see that. Every now and again somebody sends me something, a really interesting article. And again, I should have kept this article, but, you know, try and have few possessions and few things. But this was a case of a lady who was, you know, probably one of the most unfortunate. She was an identical twin in Germany during the Second World War. She was Jewish. So she got interned with her identical sister in Auschwitz under that terrible Dr. Mengele. Her daughter was the one who was, her sister, elder sister, oh no, well, about the same age. The identical twins, they have to be the same age, don't they? But the identical twin was the one who was tortured and killed. She was, you know, badly treated, but she survived. And of course, so much trauma of those days, so much pain, so much anger and wanting revenge. But then as you grew older and older and older, now that tended to be get less and less and less as you became wiser and more compassionate. And then she actually found out that one of this terrible Dr. Mengele's assistants was still alive. And she went to see him. She went to see him to give him forgiveness. And she told what it was like. It was sincere. And she said, as soon as I forgave this person who just tortured and murdered in front of me, my sister, and caused me so much pain and difficulty in my life, as soon as I gave that forgiveness, sincere forgiveness, I was no longer a victim anymore. I was a victor. I'd conquered. Just as the Buddha said, to conquer yourself is so much harder than conquering 1,000 armies using military similes. And this is beautiful, that was a really powerful act. So, it's not just through cruelty. I said, it's not cruelty. It may feel powerful, but the real power, you know, comes from letting go. Getting more of a zero ego than a big ego. So little by little, we do tend, hopefully, coming to this place, to be more powerful by being more forgiving and more kind and making bridges between people. Because sometimes big egos, what do you say is a big ego? How do you create big egos? I was going to say, I don't know, nice little story at this point of time in this talk. That time when going to a conference, not just to a talk in a radio show, I went to a conference over in Vietnam some years ago. And of course you present at the conferences, and I give my talks and presentations which are well received. But then I spend the time listening to other people's talks. Because that's great. Now I want to sort of listen to how other people teach. So I was sitting in the back. You know, somebody was giving a presentation on some aspect of Buddhism. And this was in North Vietnam. The northern part of Vietnam, it's one country. And as I was sitting there, a Vietnamese monk came and sat right next to me. He obviously wanted to practice his English. So he talked to me and said, "Where are you from?" And I replied, "Oh, I am from Australia." "Oh, really?" he said. "Do you know a monk by the name of Ajahn Brahm?" And I couldn't resist trying to get as much out of this as I possibly could. I said, "Oh, yeah, I've heard of him." Without telling any lies, because I have heard of me. "Oh, yeah, he lives in monasteries, very famous in Vietnam." "Oh, is he really?" "Yeah." He said, "What's he like?" "Oh, he's just like me." "I am Ajahn Brahm." He went, "Ah!" I'll always remember that. He put his hands out, "Ah!" And of course we laughed together. Because I don't know why people think you're well known. But anyway, sometimes it has its advantages. Because on this other occasion, that's right, I was travelling from, so now sometimes I let people know who I am because there's some advantages in it, I must admit that. Sometimes I was travelling in Garuda, and that's the airlines, from Perth to, I think it's to Denpasar, and then on to Yogyakarta to give some talks. And as I sat down in economy class by the window, just minding my own business totally, one of the flight attendants came past. And she looked at me and she stopped. And she looked me straight in the eyes and said, Are you Ajahn Brahm?" And I said, "Well, I think so. Last time I checked." And then she started gushing. She said, "Oh," she put her hand over her chest,
oh, I must be your greatest fan. I've read all of your books. It's such an honor you're on my flight. And I never felt embarrassed about being noticed. I felt, this is going to be a really good flight. And of course, when they gave the food out, is the food hot enough for you? We've got enough. Do you want extra whatever you want in your tea? She really gave me top class service. And after the meal, then I was just trying to meditate, get some peaceful time. He said, Ami, excuse me, Ajahn Brahm, could you please come to the front of the aircraft? And I thought, what's she up to? So I didn't know why. And when I got to the front of the aircraft, all of the cabin crew were all lined up for photo. And I say this, Indonesians, any Indonesians here? Indonesia? None? Well, you're gone. Oh, yeah, at the back there. Indonesia, you are the number one for photographs. Honestly, that sometimes some of the difficulties you've got me into, taking photographs, like I was going through Changi Airport, got a connecting flight. And then this whole group of about 30 Indonesian Buddhists, they've been going off on pilgrimage to India for the holy sites. And they saw me. Said, Ajahn Brahm, please come over. Come here, photo. I said, okay, I've got, half an hour. That wasn't enough. First of all, individual photos. Then the group photo. Then in pairs. And then, oh my goodness me. And that was the only time, honestly, the only time when I got to the boarding gate, they were calling out my name. Mr. Brahma Wangso, please board quickly. The flight is closing. But anyway, just so I had to have all of the aircraft staff just taking my photograph. And at the same time, this was, Perth. To Denpasar, and I was going to go on from there to Yogyakarta, where the talks were. Most of the people on the flight were not Buddhist. Most of them were surfers. And they kept on, all the lights in the front were all lighting up. Ding, ding, ding. They wanted service. Some more beer. Some more bintang. And they said, no, wait, we're busy. So I always remember that after they'd finished with me, and I could go back to my seat, I had to go right down the middle of the aircraft, because I was sitting in the back somewhere, and all the people were looking at me. Like, I had to wait for my beer because of you. Oh, well. But anyway, so when there's actually zero ego, it's also zero ego is like being able to ask forgiveness and give forgiveness, and also being able to make mistakes. And that's a problem. People always want to be perfect. You know that I'm not perfect. Sometimes I tell the same old story every time. But I always tell people, all the stories I repeat here, I've heard them more than anybody. And I still enjoy them. They're good fun. And change a little bit here, change a little bit there. But the nice thing with a zero ego, you can just, you make a mistake, you say the wrong thing, you just enjoy it and let it be. Zero ego means you're allowed to make mistakes. You don't have to be perfect. Hands up here, anyone who's perfect. Of course no one is perfect. If you were, you'd be what I call boring. It's true, isn't it? I often notice that because we live up in Bodhinyana, and that's in Serpentine on the hills. And that hill is like overlooking the ocean. I mean, the ocean's 30 kilometers away. 20, no, not maybe not that much, 20 kilometers, 15 kilometers. Because on the top of the hill, sometimes you get the most incredible sunsets, on the horizon there. And
the most incredible sunsets only occur when there's some cloud or there's some smoke on the horizon. Some days it's perfectly blue, clear sky, and it's not beautiful. It's just, you know, the sunsets rather. You need some imperfections, some smoke, or some cloud to stretch the golds and the oranges across the sky. And I always remember that. Beauty only occurs when there's some imperfections there somewhere. And that's one of the reasons why you should never try to be perfect. Otherwise you're just boring as hell. And for those people who say, well, that's okay for you, Ajahn Bhav, you live alone. But you should see the person I live with. Oh, they're really so imperfect. And then I say, well, so are you, aren't you? And they'll say, yeah, that's true. And I say, well, you're a match. So when we celebrate imperfection, we're celebrating humanity, reality, truth. And we're not trying to be this incredible ego. There's zero ego. And sometimes you are perfect, and sometimes you make mistakes. Welcome to life, which is a real you. The whole of it is who you are. But the amazing thing, which is weird, something which Ajahn Chah tried to teach me, but I was too dumb to really know at the time, but over the years you reflect, you learn, and it's so true that when you try to be perfect, you make so many mistakes. Why? I was really trying hard to keep my rules, be a really good monk, sit straight, give good talks and all of that. But then it never seemed to work. Until I thought, okay, I'm just going to relax and see what happens. And the more I relaxed, the easier it became to keep my monastic rules. And there's a lot of rules which I have to keep. When you relax with it, it's easy. When I'm relaxed giving talks, when I don't worry, you know, what happens, the talks are much better. And when I'm relaxed, just being with you, not trying to prove anything or get anything out of you. Just like that lady who called one evening. She was an East European. There's a phone call for you, Ajahn Bhav. She insists on talking with you. So I answered it. He said, are you giving a talk tonight? And I said, yes. And she said, how much do you charge? And I said, nothing. We don't charge. There's no entry fee to come in here. We don't take names and just harass you afterwards. I once thought of raising funds. We can actually have no entry fee, but you have to pay to get out. We don't do fraudulent things like that. But I said, no, you don't have to pay anything. He said, no, you don't understand. She raised her voice. Dollars. Cents. So how much do I have to pay to get in for the talk? I said, ma'am, you don't have to pay anything at all. You just come in if you like it. You can stay. If you don't like it, you can just go straight out the door again and no one will stop you or criticize you. You know that's the way we do things here. But then, the reason I tell this story is what she asked next. She said, well, what do you guys get out of this then? It's a very valid question. Why do we do this? You do it because you get so much happiness and joy. Giving. That's why we do things. Not for big egos, for big hearts. A lot of happiness. A lot of joy. So when you have zero ego, it's like all the important stuff goes from up here to down here into your heart. And you don't need to worry about how big your heart is. How big your head is, your big ego, yeah, that's dangerous. But kindness and joy, which you always get from giving to others, expecting nothing back in return, you can give as much as you like there. That's zero ego. You're giving. Not expecting anything back in return. And in all my journeys in life, you've seen such happy people, such joyful people, we're just, you know, they see that somebody here needs to lift home somewhere, to Fremantle or to Joondalup up or somewhere, and if they need a lift home, they don't need to get a taxi. So I can take you. And you give them a lift. And you give them some kindness, some joy. That is a beautiful thing to see. And it's, you don't want anything out of it. You do that just because it needs to be done. It's what we call the, what was it, when I was over in Berkeley, met that fellow Mehta, his name was M-E-H-T-H-A or something. You know, he's really pushing the pay it forward philosophy. That's, you know, it's nothing new, it's just a nice word, pay it forward, instead of pay it back. Pay it back. That's just negative almost. You're not making any progress. Pay it forward. Go ahead in life. What does that mean? What it meant was what Ajahn Chah taught me, my teacher in Thailand. He said specifically, when I, you know, started to understand some, only a tiny bit of what he was teaching me, I said, thank you, that's so brilliant. Thank you so much. I'm so lucky to have you as my teacher. He said, stop that. Don't pay it back to me. Because if I've given you anything, said Ajahn Chah, then you give it back to me, it's all finished. But he said, whatever I've taught you, whatever I've given to you, however I've inspired you, helped you, you're in debt to me, he said. And I felt that. I was in a huge amount of debt. Not financial, obviously, but emotional, giving, I don't know, respect, gratitude, had so much debt to him. He said, the only way you can pay that back is giving it to others. He said, I've served you as a disciple. Now your job is to serve others, to pay it forward. So I teach you out of gratitude to Ajahn Chah to pay off my debt to him. I'm paying it forward to you. And of course, if I've been of any service at all to you or any other monks, nuns, lay people, whoever, who've taught in this place, if they've helped you, then you're in debt. And the only way you can't thank me or give donations to this temple, or you can't pay it back that way, the only way you can pay it back is pay it forward. Give some kindness, forgiveness, some service, some joy, some letting go to someone else. That's part of the zero ego thing. It's just like, you know, you're part of this wonderful, what they call in Buddhism, the rolling of the wheel of Dhamma, just going forward and forward. It is, okay, I'm going to break a promise. I don't think you mind, because I promised myself I will not mention the word coronavirus this evening. But that's the Dhamma, it's like a virus. It spreads that way, and you pay it forward, whoever you meet catches it from you. Catches a bit of kindness and forgiveness and help and just a little smile. You don't have to do much to pay it forward. I've done that a lot in my life, obviously. Just going through the airport, you see someone who's very busy and just give a smile. So easy to do. And for some people, it just means so much to them. Someone is happy to me today. There was this one monk a long time ago, he said that it was something simple. You know, he was on a train in India years and years and years ago. And a long time ago, maybe 50 years ago now, probably 60, I don't know, a long time ago. And there's this really big guy, very fierce. And as the monk got off the train, he just smiled at this man, said, good morning. And that was a sincere good wish. And this man just, whoa, because he was a leader of a big group of bandits. You know, he was a gang leader. And the police were just really searching for him. He said that just word of good morning with a smile, sincere thanks, changed his life. He gave up being a bandit. It's just, I got a good life, became a good person. sometimes small things have huge differences to you. It's one of the reasons why a tiny seed just makes a whole forest. So that's why sometimes paying it forward is not wanting something back. It's just giving, not even, sometimes I was taught to give expecting nothing back in return. No, it doesn't work for me. I don't expect in return, but I expect it to be returned to others. And any act of giving, goodness, wonderful things, sharing, wisdom, just somebody giving you respect. Then you give respect to somebody else. And give respect to somebody else. And respect somebody else. That way it goes so far in this world. And you find actually you make a difference. It is like, you know, these viruses, but they just multiply just so much. Which is one of the reasons why one of those other jokes, well, you've heard all my jokes before, but it's nice to share them. You tell your bosses at work that, you know, you caught a disease from this monk, the Happy Titus B virus. And they said, no, what? I said, Happy Titus. Happy Titus B. And please don't isolate yourself if you have Happy Titus B. Don't put yourself in quarantine. Spread it. Spread it around far and wide. Happy Titus B. Or just, you know, respect for other people. That's one of the things which I was actually going to... Oh, why not? Make it a bit longer. The other thing was just saying zero ego. Ego is just within the walls, you know, who you think you are. I'm a Buddhist, I'm a man, I'm old, I'm young, this is who I am, I'm smart, I'm wise. Those are like walls which you put yourself in. To actually to delete that ego, you've got to break down those walls. So this particular story which I was sharing when I was over in Indonesia was when... Because I really do try hard to actually make connections with people of different religions. And the one of these was in the Anglican Church that, what was it, Frank Sheehan. He was the, I met him when I was doing some teachings at the Cancer Research, the Cancer Wellness Group, a group up in Cottesloe I go to a lot. And he was also going over there and became good friends. And he was a chaplain at Christ Church Grammar School. You know, it's a beautiful school. And one of the top schools, costs an arm and a leg to go there. And, of course, except if you're Ajahn Brahm, you just walk in because you know people. But not me, not to study over there. I went there one morning to give... The teaching at the morning assembly. They still do that. And so I was waiting outside with the principal and Father Frank Sheehan, the chaplain, the three of us outside. And the principal, he was very respectful. He obviously didn't really know who I was, actually how I work, because he turned to me and he said, once all of the children are calmed down, you know, at the beginning of the day, in the main assembly hall, the three of us are going to go into the hall. And there's a statue of Jesus there. We're going to bow to that statue of Jesus, but you're a Buddhist monk, you don't have to bow. And I took my opportunity. I'm not going to let this pass. I turned round to him, the principal, and I said with a serious face, no smile, not yet, just afterwards, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. I don't know if this is a good thing. I mean, actually it works. I don't mind. This was a good thing. And you see his face get all confused. But because I knew that Frank Sheehan knew me, so he said, oh, he's okay. And so when we went into the chapel, we all bowed to the statue of Jesus there. I'm a Buddhist monk. I'm not a Christian, I'm a Buddhist. And then I explained why. How I was thinking. I said, in your stature, I mentioned this to the kids in the assembly. I always make up my talks as I go along. Don't plan things. I said, I bowed, you may have seen me bow, to, you know, just a small from the waist bow, to your stature of Jesus, because there's something in there which I can respect. Not everything, but there's enough there which I can respect, and that's what I'm bowing to. The part which I see in that figure, which I can, I think is wonderful. And I said, it's the same whenever I bow to the Buddha statue. Three times I bow to the Buddha statue, and the first bow is always to virtue. Goodness, honesty, trustworthiness, reliability. I'll always come and try and keep my promises as much as I can. To come here and give a talk, because you're expecting me to. I don't want to let people down, that's unvirtuous. I'm not lying and cheating people. That is really important to me. So important. I worship virtue. I bow down, and the Buddha, I'm thinking, virtue. I'm worshipping virtue, because that's what the Buddha stands for me, the first thing. And the second thing I bow down to is peace. Peace in your family. Peace in your workplace. Peace in the world. Peace in your heart when you're meditating. Peace in monastery where I live. Peace. How important is that? And you all know, you don't have to be fully enlightened and get into jhanas to understand what the meaning of peace is. When you feel some peace in your life, that is magnificent. That is worth bowing down to. That's what I do, I bow down to it. I remember all those peaceful moments in my life, all the peace which, you know, I've tried to bring about, where I still need to work more, building more peace. It's an important thing in my life, so I bow down to it. And lastly, the third bow is always for compassion, kindness. Because every time I see acts of kindness and compassion, people really go that extra, not mile, extra light year for somebody else. Really kind, compassion. When you see genuine acts of kindness, doesn't that just really just bang, explode your heart? Wow, it's wonderful people can be such kind and generous and compassionate. I remember all those acts of compassion I've seen, and I just bow down. So that's what I bow down to, I said. So virtue, peace and compassion. And everybody got it. People ask me, why do these Buddhists keep bowing down to these idols? They are idols, they're my three big idols, what the Buddha stands for, virtue, peace and compassion. They can understand that. So you know what happened next? I'd better finish off the talk soon. What happened next was 2 weeks later, the school said, we want to visit your monastery. So they all came down in about two or three buses. And first person out of the bus was the principal. He came himself. Now, principals of schools like that, I know, are really busy. They've got lots of work to do. You know, he didn't actually come that great distance, an hour and a half from school, probably in a big bus like that, from, was it Claremont or something. So all that way, and he came, he said, Ajahn Brahm, thank you, I have to come to this monastery because you really inspired me. And he said, can we go and see the hall? So we took him inside the main hall in Bodhinyana Monastery, just the two of us. I wished today that there was a camera to take a photo of both of us side by side, bowing three times down to the Buddha statue there. Was it to the Buddha statue? Ah, it was to virtue, peace and compassion. Zero egos. Kindness, joy. That's how this works. So that's my talk tonight. So no plan, but I think it came out okay. Hope you enjoyed it. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yay. Okay, now we have the questions from overseas. See who we got today on the list. And any questions from the people here? You're most welcome to ask questions. But we'll do the ones from here, from the overseas first. From Brazil, UK and Switzerland. Nils from Brazil, I'm having a great time meditating. Wonderful. However, I struggle with anger. How is it related to ego? How can one eliminate and weaken ego? Of course, anger is really related to ego, because if you have ego, you want to control. You feel you're in power over things. You feel you're in power over things, over people, over even material things. I still remember, I wrote about this story in one of the books, our old days here, when there was no air con, had all the windows open on a hot day, going down these, going Leech Highway or something, and getting to a red traffic light and stopping. You had to. And the car next to me had also stopped. Now, I was in the passenger seat, obviously, because, you know, monks aren't allowed to drive. This fellow was next to me, in the driver's seat, in the car next to me, and he was swearing at the traffic lights. You stupid traffic lights, you know, you knew I was in a hurry, why you just changed to red? It's not the first time you've done this, I'm going to be in big trouble now, you stupid traffic lights, you've got it in for me, haven't you? There's something... He was getting angry at traffic lights, which are just like automatic, you know. So you can get angry at automatic things. How many of you got angry at your computer for crashing or for freezing when it's really important for you? So it's not their fault. They're just, you know, following instructions. So that a lot of your anger, even people that just, you know, that's their nature, they follow instructions. Why you get angry that they make mistakes or they're slow or they can't come up on time when it's really important for you? So it's one of the reasons you have great time meditating. Wonderful. Use some of that joy to understand the nature of life is out of control. I love that idea. Out of control. And I'm not going to try and control it. I'm going to just be with it, float with it. Even people who go surfing in Western Australia, they go one with the wave. They don't try and control the wave or beat the wave or submit to the wave. They just merge with the wave. You merge with the red traffic lights. You merge with the people you live with. You don't try and control them or be better than them. And then your anger disappears when you're not controlling. When your anger disappears, you disappear too. Emerging, you're not being an individual against another person. In the UK, sometimes having an ego can feel beneficial or we get benefits from it. That's true. Because if I didn't have an ego, I wouldn't be able to get a passport and go through the customs. You know, that's... I told a story. Yeah, okay, here it comes. I think I've told this story so many times here, but anyway, here it comes again. This time when I decided, because I was getting old, to get an old people's card, the Commonwealth Seniors Card. Basically an old people's card. They call it Seniors Card. But old and wrinkly card. So anyway, I went online. That wasn't good enough. I had to go up into the Centrelink in Armidale, an appointment in the office there. I said, why? Why can't I do it online? Because of identity fraud. I said, look, no one will try and steal my identity. It's too much hard work. And they said, no, we need you to come in. So I went in there, made the appointment. This lady was in front of me, and the first thing she said was, can you please prove who you are? And I said, I've been a monk for 45 years trying to find the answer to that question. I think that's almost exactly what I said. And they never laughed. They didn't laugh at all. They looked at me just with anger. And said, this is serious. Have you got any ID? You know, identification. That's when it really started getting funny. I said, have you got your driver's license? I don't have a driver's license. Okay. How about your rental agreement? You know, for your where you live. I said, I don't rent. Oh, do you own? Have you got your house ownership certificate? No, I don't own a house. You know, straight away they think you live under a bridge or something. But anyway, I said, no, I don't own anything. They said, okay, what about your credit card? Come on, don't have a credit card. Your bank account, don't have that. And the next one they asked for, my marriage certificate. They actually asked for that, which is weird. They said, I don't have any of that. And they went through a few other little things which you're supposed to have and I don't have. And she looked at me and she was actually serious. She said, look, according to the, you know, the government and, you know, the Centrelink, whatever it is, she said, you just don't exist. You don't exist. And then I put my hands up. I couldn't resist it. I said, Sadhu, the Buddha was right. I don't exist. Well, anyway, that's what happens sometimes when, if you have an ego and credit cards and stuff, then you actually exist and get easy to get. They gave me the card anyway. I think I was just too much of a bother for them. So anyway, how can we practice non-ego when there seems to be benefits from having one? There's more benefits from not having one. That's why. And when you really need one, you just make one up as you go along. So I can make one up as being the expert on adult themes, when I want to make that one up, which is weird. Or being the comedian when you're on the underground train. That's a nice one to make up. Being a serious monk when it's time to be a serious monk. You can make up many egos. Which one is the right you? None of them. You just make use of them for the right time, the right place. That's when you don't have an ego. You're free to have whichever ego you wish from time to time. And Nasi from Switzerland. How can I be sure that my practice is not driven by ego, e.g. being too idealistic about Buddhist practice and livelihood? Give it a try, being idealistic about Buddhist practice and livelihood. Come and be a monk at Bodhinyana Monastery. Why not? And if you are, then idealistic? Wow. Peace, stillness, freedom. The opportunity to give endlessly to others. Wow. What's wrong with that? That's not driven by ego. That's driven by kindness. Kindness and ego are almost opposites to each other. Ego controls and invents and owns and doesn't share. It controls and doesn't let go and forgive. Kindness does all those opposites. The way of kindness, the way of peace. So, any questions from the audience in front of me? Yay! Okay, you've got to run with the... We already run out of breath, Bill. We had to get someone a bit younger to do the...
Ajahn Brahm, please. Could you give me some advice, like tips in 3 steps? What could I do to melt my ego?
To lessen your ego. First of all, if you try and improve yourself, that's usually ego. So to lessen your ego, you meditate, smile, share, give, volunteer for services. Little by little, but then actually you're doing like the paying it forward. And then little by little your ego just vanishes. It's wonderful when the ego vanishes, you're just not there anymore.
Thank you.
Excellent. Any other questions, Eddie? Okay, later, okay. It's not the same without Eddie.
Okay, since you mentioned about Ajahn Brahm, this question, you know, your talk there is no ego. This one is not directly related, but it's indirectly, you know. It's regarding Corona.
Oh. Okay.
Don't you think the world, you know, we are overreacting, you know, to this coronavirus thing, you know. Bearing in mind that, you know, the flu in here, our country here, Australia, we have 3,000 to 4,000 deaths a year, you know. Yeah. In the USA, they have 25,000 to 69,000 deaths a year.
Yeah.
And then this is coming back to the mind, you know, our mind is, we're old, our mind is like being, how to say, created by this wave of fear and all, you know?
Yeah, there are 3 cases in Western Australia. there are 3 million people in Western Australia. Figure it out for yourself.
Thank you.
I know I told a few people about my method for actually eradicating coronavirus from Wuhan district in China. I told a few people beforehand how I can do this. There's something in Buddhism which, if you come to monastery, you see what we call like the holy water. We get this water in a bowl, we bless it, it's really powerful sometimes, really, really powerful. At the same time, just right now, we've got all these out-of-use water bombers which they use to fight the fires during the fire season. And putting these two together, we can take one of these huge water bombers, which are now not being used because there's no fires, and I can bless all the water in them. We go over Wuhan, and we just sprinkle the whole of that city with this holy water, blessed, super blessed holy water, to end the virus. Don't you think that's a good idea? At least it's a good idea because it made you laugh, and that was my main aim. So thank you all for listening. So now actually we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. It's 9 o'clock, or just past 9 o'clock. And any personal questions you can come up and ask in a few moments. And of course, thank you, Eddie, for actually joining in.